Good morning, New Mexico. Welcome to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. My name is Mary Charlotte. We're broadcasting from the Santa Fe Baking Company, streaming on the web at ksfr.org, podcasting at santaferadiocafe.org, thanks to Dotfoil Computer Services, and we're at facebook.com/radiocafe. I'd like to welcome Ron Kill. He is an artist. He calls himself a Western artist, and he is the artist whose work is featured on the Centennial New Mexico calendar, celebrating 100 years of statehood, that's been put out by New Mexico Magazine. And tomorrow, September 17th, Saturday, at the New Mexico History Museum, there's going to be a signing where Ron Kill will be there signing calendars and posters, and Mark Simmons, the writer who wrote the foreword to this calendar, will be there as well. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Thank you, Mary. Thank you for having me.
So this is the work that is in this calendar is from a mural, a very big mural that is at the Frank Brownell Museum of the Southwest, which is outside of Raton. You have spent your life being both an artist and a cowboy.
Yes, ma'am.
And so that is the origin of your vision of New Mexico history.
That and a lifelong love of history, too. I've had that ever since I was a child. So it came together very well. In 2008, I secured the commission to paint a mural to go around a brand new museum that was recently opened at the NRA Whittington Center just south of Raton. It's the Frank Brownell Museum of the Southwest, and at the time, it was just an empty shell. They didn't even have any exhibits in it. So I got there at just the right time, and I asked them if they needed the services of an artist, and they said they certainly did. And what it led to was a mural that's approximately 100 feet long, goes around the entire inside of the museum. And what the folks at Whittington wanted was something that showed the history of New Mexico, with emphasis on northeastern New Mexico, but New Mexico history. And they gave me a free rein, which I can tell you an artist loves. The less restrictions, the better. That allows those creative juices to flow. And I went from there. It took me 2 years to paint the mural.
Had you ever painted a mural before?
No, I hadn't. I had always wanted to, though. I'd admired many artists like Maynard Dixon, who had painted murals. One of my favorite artists is Charlie Russell. He painted several close to murals and one mural at the end of his life. So I always thought that I could handle it if I got the opportunity, and I got the opportunity.
So when you're conceiving of something like this, I mean, you started with essentially what we might call prehistoric New Mexico, mm-hmm. the first people who inhabited this part of the country.
I thought that was a good place to start.
Yeah.
Especially in northeastern New Mexico, by great coincidence, is Folsom and the site of Folsom Man, the Paleo-Indians who, people argue about the dates, but one of the dates to settle on is 10,000 years ago, were living up there and hunting. One of the first places they ever found a Folsom Point, which is an intricately chipped arrowhead, spearhead, was at Folsom. So I thought, what better place to start than with Folsom Man? And I show the very first image up in the calendar, our group of Paleo-Indians hunting the prehistoric buffalo of the time, which was considerably bigger than the buffalo we have today.
Right.
And it was a difficult chore to secure your meal that way.
Indeed.
And I have an action sequence showing that. So I started with the Paleo-Indians, and I went all the way to approximately 1900. And I put a great deal of emphasis on the Santa Fe Trail, because the trail runs right across the Whittington Center. And one of the few places, the trail starts in central Missouri, and it goes all the way to Santa Fe. Much of the trail is on private property, and it's hard to get access to it. On the Whittington Center, it's open to the public. And what I like to do whenever I go up there is I park my truck and I walk the trail for several miles. You can see some ruts, but you are where the wagons rolled. You are where the herds went through, where Kit Carson rode.
And do you kind of imagine
what
it was like? And
I do. That's one of the things I love to do best. I like to go places where history was, and erase what is, and put myself back into the past. Yeah. I'm essentially a 19th century man. It's easy for me to do that. And since I paint primarily history, my vision of the past is very strong.
What do you mean you're a 19th century man?
Well, we're here in the 21st century. It's very modern. A lot of new modern gizmos and gadgets. my sensibilities, my way of looking at the world is more old-fashioned. I used to cowboy for a living. It's a fairly primitive vocation. It's modernized.
It used to be a lot more primitive.
It used to be. It really, really did. Back in the 70s when I started working on ranches.
Well, back in the 19th century.
Yes. But even if you want to compare the 1970s to right now, I mean, I know fellas that have cell phones with them when they're a horseback. Back then, that was... Well,
I'm
we
surprised
didn't have cell
they can
phones,
get reception.
Yeah, some places you ride to the top of a mountain and take your chances. The way I see life is more through the eyes of the people that were here 100 years ago than it is through people that live today. Just to be perfectly honest with you, I don't own a computer. I don't associate with computers. I do have a website, but I have a friend that manages it for me. I prefer the old-fashioned values, the old-fashioned way of doing things. And it helps me portray people back then, too.
Yeah, I mean, that all definitely has a deep effect on your art.
Yes, ma'am.
Now, you grew up in Albuquerque, city boy, I guess, kind of. Or
well,
you
none
just
of my family was involved in agriculture. My cousins had horses, so I grew up around horses.
Okay.
But I always wanted to get out on the ranches.
And then you decided to become a cowboy.
I did. And unlike some fellas who, they have artistic inclinations and they go to ranches just to gather information so they can paint it more accurately, I always wanted to learn the vocation. And cow work was the way I made my living for many years. And in fact, I still do go out to friends' ranches, neighboring ranches, and help with the spring gather and the fall shipping. I like to keep my hand in that way.
And meanwhile, the while that you were doing that, you were also an artist.
Yes, ma'am, I sure was. Essentially self-taught. I tried a stint at University of New Mexico. I went there and I found that their art education was, shall we say, somewhat abstract, and I am not. So I went down to New Mexico State, and I stayed down there for a few semesters. They had some good life drawing classes. They were a little bit more focused, but it wasn't what I needed. So I quit college for what it was worth, and I just loaded everything I had into the back of my pickup, which consisted of a suitcase, my saddle, my war bag, and a box full of sketchbooks, and I just drifted from ranch to ranch to ranch.
Cowboying and drawing.
Yes.
And so this is really a culmination of a lifetime worth of work. This mural project that we can experience even if we don't go to Raton, New Mexico, in the form of this 2012 calendar celebrating New Mexico's statehood. I mean, the challenges of a mural must be fascinating because you depict over time, I mean, you depict essentially a narrative in still scenes over a very large amount of wall.
A great spectrum in time and a great spectrum in space, square footage, yes. What I did is I painted the mural on 6-foot masonite panels, and I would deliver them 2 and 3 at a time. So it was installed as a work in progress over the 2-year period until its completion. And again, as I said, I had a free rein, and I decided, you know, here in New Mexico we have such a wonderful history with so many different people. And I don't include moral judgments in my work. As an artist slash historian, I document the facts. And if, you know, sometimes people don't like the way history turned out, well, history is what it was. I just try to paint it and give the folks who were here their shot. For instance, after the Paleo Indians, the next sequence in the mural are the Querechos. That's what the Spanish called who we now know were the ancestors of the Apache, the Plains Apache. They wandered over the plains with all their possessions on the backs of dogs. The horse hadn't arrived with the Spanish yet. The dog, Travoy.
Pack dogs.
When you think about it, the Spanish encountered them, Coronado, in 1540, and he said, we came across bands of Indians with 500 to 1,000 dogs. All of these Indians' possessions were on the backs of the dogs.
I did not know this.
They wandered afoot, following the buffalo herds, because that was the sustenance of their life. They lived to hunt, and they lived to hunt the buffalo. What a vision. What a thought.
Yeah.
Here they were wandering across not only New Mexico, but parts of southern Colorado, Texas Panhandle. they're very seldom, if ever, depicted. Most people don't even know they existed. I got them a nice little shot in the mural because they deserve to be remembered.
Ron Kill is an artist, a Western artist, cowboy artist, and if people want to actually go up to this Frank Brownell Museum in Museum of the Southwest in Raton, it's not too far a drive from here,
no,
from Santa Fe.
No, it's only about 2 hours.
Yeah.
So a pleasant drive right up the Santa Fe Trail.
Right.
If you can, you get a hold of the Traveler's Guide to the Santa Fe Trail, take it with you. You can read. In fact, that's the book that Mark Simmons wrote. You can read as you go along. Trail history, trail markers, all the way there. It'd be a wonderful experience for anybody that wants to think about what the Santa Fe Trail was like. And then as soon as you get there, you've got the museum. You can actually walk the trail.
Exactly.
You know, the interstates
put
there...
put themselves into that mindset.
The scenery hasn't changed,
yeah.
Essentially. That's one of the great things about New Mexico. Unlike other parts of the West that have been industrialized, changed, reformed, what have you. Here, sure, you've got ribbons of concrete. You've got towns that have gotten bigger. But Red River Peak is on the grounds, and it is a Santa Fe trail marker. In fact, it is in the mural. It's one of the first things that you saw when you came south. You crossed Raton Pass, and it looms up to your west, and you guided yourself right around Red River Peak. That view hasn't changed. It's essentially the same. The country is the same. The antelope herds are the same. Now, there still are a few private ranches where you can come across buffalo herds. The sense of what it was like is still there. If you've got the eyes to see it, and you've
right.
got just a little bit of romance in you, because that's what it takes to mix it all together and make it work.
Ron Kill and Mark Simmons will be at the New Mexico History Museum tomorrow, Saturday the 17th of September, from 2 to 4 in the afternoon. And you can get a copy of this calendar and a poster, which has one of the images.
Yes, ma'am. I illustrated the centennial poster. And it will also be available for sale. We'll be signing both of them. Mark will be saying a few words on the centennial itself, the event of New Mexico gaining statehood. And I'll be talking a little bit about history up until the centennial. In essence, I'll be narrating a little bit from what I painted in the calendar.
Ron Kill, wonderful work. Thank you so much for joining us on the Radio Cafe.
Thank you, ma'am. Pleasure to be here.
I'm delighted now to welcome to the program Paul Coker Jr. He is a cartoonist for decades now with Mad Magazine, and Mike Bundy is here. He's the director of the Chuck Jones Gallery here in Santa Fe, and there is an opening of Paul Coker's work tonight from 5 to 8. Welcome, gentlemen, to the Radio Cafe.
Thank you very much.
Thank you very much.
So you, Paul Coker, illustrated, did drawings for, and did the... when you do a cartoon for Mad Magazine or you do a series, are you coming up with the ideas? Are you coming up with the humor yourself? Or do you also have writers you work with?
Generally writers, yes. Mine is the easy part. I just illustrate what a writer has written. And with any luck, try to make it funnier.
Through the nature
drawing.
Of the drawing.
Yeah, yeah.
So it's a real collaborative process.
Yes.
I mean, I imagine that they're thinking of your way of drawing and you are thinking of their sense of humor and doing something which is bigger than the sum of the parts.
Maybe. Most writers are not illustrators or cartoonists. And so they sometimes don't have a good idea of space limitations or what else can be done with their words. So it's up to me to try to make it funnier.
How did you get started as a cartoonist, and then how did you end up at MAD?
I'm sure this program isn't long enough. cartooning and artwork generally starts very early on. And you're encouraged by your teachers, your parents, friends, and suddenly you're noted as a cartoonist. So it just naturally progresses through school and on to where I am now, which is real old.
Well, you started in, 1961 at MAD?
Well, with MAD, yes. I worked with Hallmark cards in Kansas City for several years. And then I had a freelance contract with Hallmark. And I did commercial work in New York. And then finally, not finally, but a friend of mine from the University of Kansas and Hallmark named Phil Hahn wanted me to do some work, illustrate some work that he had done, and he thought it would work out for Mad Magazine. And so I drew this story for him.
Do you remember what it was?
No. That was a long time ago.
Yeah.
But in any event, that's the way I started. I probably never would have gone to Mad with a portfolio of samples. But he encouraged me, Phil Hahn encouraged me. And as it turned out, they bought the article and they bought the drawings. And he became a fairly regular writer, and I became a regular cartoonist for Mad.
I was trying to imagine what it would be like to work at Mad, or indeed for South Park, or for somebody whose basic whole reason for being is to make people laugh and to poke fun at society and its foibles and its stupidities and its evils and all of that. And, I mean, so you work at Mad Magazine. You work there for a long time. What's it like? Is it anarchic? Are people laughing all the time? Is it very serious?
I know what you're asking. And unfortunately, as is the case for most people that work for Mad Magazine, they generally don't come near the office. They all work at home as freelance people. That's the way I worked, and all the writers and artists that I know were freelance. So we really don't come in contact with the editors other than over the phone or FedEx or whatever the latest technology is. But I think you'd probably be very disappointed if you got in their office, because it's, you know, it's a serious commercial operation,
right?
And although they are funny, but it's not all day jokes and, you know, scratching and laughing and all of that.
Now, I was reading, there's a kind of a memoir by one of the people who worked at Mad Magazine, in which he talks about how there were quite a number of trips that the different artists took together.
Yes. The publisher of Mad, Bill Gaines, he unfortunately is now dead. He used to give the staff a trip every year. You didn't have to go on the trip, but you wouldn't get paid for the trip if you didn't go. So this was just a bonus, basically. And really, for me, one of the greatest things that I've ever had happen to me in terms of, well, really, now that I think about it, maybe the best thing that's ever happened to me, because I got to go places that I might have thought about going, but never, ever would have taken the time, set aside the time, and certainly not free.
Right.
Everything was free. Wow. Of course, airfare, the hotels, the meals. And fortunately, Bill Gaines was something of a gourmet. He was also a gourmand, but he loved to eat. And we always knew, wherever we were, that we would get wonderful meals, whether it's Paris or Africa or Russia or Japan or
Tahiti.
Tahiti, yes. He was one. You must have a list.
No, I just remember the guy talking about going to Tahiti. And I mean, it seems like that must be at least one time where you weren't all working at home separately from each other, but actually did get to know one another.
Yes.
Was there a kind of creative part to it?
It's always nice to know whose work you're dealing with in terms of writers. And it's fun to talk over. We all had something in common, and that was Mad Magazine. And you're a writer or you're a cartoonist. I would hate to try to justify the trips with the IRS, but it was a sort of get-together each year.
When times are really bad politically because of war or corrupt politicians...
when is it not?
When is it not? Good point. But, I mean, it seems like those would be the best times for a cartoonist.
I think that's probably true, especially when you have people that are easily caricatured.
Who are the easiest to caricature?
I'm glad you asked me that. No, I'm not glad you asked me that, because it depends. At the moment, Gaddafi is probably as easy as anyone. Hmm. But... I don't know.
Nixon?
Well, of course, Nixon. George Bush was fairly easy. Barack Obama's pretty easy. Well, now that I think about it, eventually almost every politician is easy to do. Now, I don't know whether it would be... I'm thinking now about... right, that fellow. Or those two fellows. Two prominent... Republicans, Texas, Massachusetts.
Oh, Perry and Romney.
See, thank you.
You're welcome. That's why I'm here.
You've been very quiet.
Well, I'm listening to your genius. So.
Yeah, right.
So Perry and Romney also on the easy. Well,
their faces are very regular. Perry has the hair. And a very strong face. Romney has a kind of a rectangular face. Very nice looking fellow. Nowhere near as easy as, say, Nixon.
Right.
To actually draw a caricature of.
Yeah, yeah. And be recognizable. That obviously is the... if you don't know who it is, then that is a problem.
That's a problem. You said the other day that Michelle Bachmann was actually difficult to do.
Difficult because she's a very nice-looking woman.
Huh.
Her eyes and her large hairdo are probably the most distinctive features.
Now, one thing that I was thinking about, because I went into the gallery earlier in the week and was looking at all the pieces that are going to be in the show. We're talking to Mad Magazine cartoonist Paul Coker Jr., and... Although it's you certainly caricature both Democrats and Republicans, I found myself wondering whether, I mean, Mad Magazine and these other outlets for humor, are the people who are doing these caricatures and doing these cartoons and doing these pieces more likely to be on the Democratic side of the spectrum?
That's a way of putting it. Most... Yes, Democratic, but almost certainly liberal.
And why is that?
Perhaps they pay more attention to what's going on. No, that's
maybe.
That's not a that's not a nice thing to say about the Republicans.
We don't have to be nice.
the magazine takes a liberal point of view.
But I mean, what I was wondering was being able to laugh at yourself, laugh at others, see through things, see the holes in arguments and things like that, as opposed to taking a hard line and waving the flag and not really taking more of an analytical approach. It does seem to be more the Democratic way, so it seems like... And I don't know if this is true, but just as I was thinking about it, as I was looking at your work, it seems like there is a correlation between having a sense of humor and satire and being on the liberal side?
Possibly, although in the New Mexican, the local newspaper, they have a comic strip right next to Gary Trudeau.
Right.
And they do it for balance.
I know, but it's not as funny.
Well, it isn't.
It isn't.
It just isn't.
It may be difficult to be humorous, funny.
When you're an uptight Republican, it's hard to be funny.
I mean, I'm not. Although this may not sound like, I'm not trying to be partisan. I was just trying to understand what's going on.
Well, I can't explain.
Yeah.
Matt definitely is a more liberal leaning magazine. And it's fun to make fun of, for instance, the Tea Party and those who subscribe to their point of view, at least for me.
Now, one of the brunts of your cartoons lately has been Donald Trump, and particularly his hair.
Yes, well, Donald Trump is his hair, so that you can draw him from the back, and
it's huge.
You
Sorry.
Know absolutely who it is. Most of those Donald Trump cartoons were the fellow who did the idea is Don Edwing, and he's been a writer for Mad for many years. And once he began doing Donald Trump and making fun of his hair and everything, it just led to a whole series. And fortunately, I was asked to draw those.
Are certain...
And I agreed with them. I mean, I'm not a Donald Trump fan.
Huh. That surprises me a little bit. Yeah.
Well, because of my hair.
Yeah, because of your hair. Yes.
Yeah, right. Jealous.
Absolutely, I'm envious.
We're talking to Paul Coker Jr. and Mike Bundy, and the opening tonight is at the Chuck Jones Gallery. Now, when you're such a wonderful artist, and the characters you draw have so much life to them, and they're just great caricatures. And I wonder, do you ever do straight drawing, like non-caricature drawing from life?
As a matter of fact, since I moved to Santa Fe, I do quite a bit of life drawing.
Hmm.
I enjoy it tremendously. And not just because of the naked people, but... Well, that's
that
a good portion
yeah.
of it. Let's be candid. But yes, I do drawings. In fact, I go to during the winter time. I go to at least four groups a week
of drawing from a model.
From a yeah,
as
yeah.
opposed to going out and drawing a landscape or. Trees.
Right. I enjoy figure drawing. I enjoy portrait. And you can do it inside as opposed to landscapes where sometimes you go out, it's too windy, it's too cold, it's too dusty, it's all those things. Inside, you don't have that problem.
Now, with all the political and social satire that you do, I mean, there are people writing journalism and they're writing very earnestly about these subjects. You approach them with humor. What does that, or what do you hope that it does for the body politic, for the people?
Oh, I don't know. If people see what I'm doing, the cartoons, and enjoy them, that's quite enough. I'm not trying to influence anybody, really.
When you work with a writer, are there certain writers that are compatible with certain cartoonists? Do you form kind of bonds and teams that work together particularly well?
The only one that I've ever found that I work with reasonably well is a fellow named Phil Hahn. And Phil and I since we worked at Hallmark together, we sort of know, you know, what is going to happen. And he understands how I draw, and I sort of understand how he writes. And incidentally, Phil has gone on to much bigger and better things. He was the head writer for Laugh-In, and he won a, is it a Tony? Is that the television prize? Yeah. And he wrote for many big stars in Hollywood for television. He's the only one I've really worked with regularly.
Mike Bundy, you were having this opening tonight. You were with the Chuck Jones Gallery. So basically, you make a living selling artwork that's based in the cartoon genre.
Correct.
And there's a whole market for that, I guess.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah.
Who collects this type of work?
We hope so.
Yeah.
Well, the people who collect it, it really are mostly baby boomers. And I think what drives a collector to collect this type of art is childhood memories. You know, it really is. It's a nostalgia-driven market. It's, you know, people remembering the very simple Saturday morning cartoons and their PJs eating their favorite cereal. And I think those memories are so deeply embedded in people of a particular age that the work just brings tremendous joy to them when they see it and when they collect it. And, you know, I know for myself, I have a very modest animation collection, but it's art that makes you smile. You know, it really does. It's virtually impossible to come into my gallery and be in a bad mood or to stay in a bad mood. I guarantee it. If you come through my gallery and just do a tip through the gallery, 5-10 minutes, you'll be smiling. You just will be, and you'll feel better. And I think it really is something that people cherish, and I think that's why they collect it.
I have to ask you before we go, Paul Coker, Alfred E. Newman. Every cartoonist has to, for Mad Magazine, has to, in their way, draw Alfred E. Newman. Is that correct?
Generally, yes. That's right. But Alfred E. Newman was a character that was developed long before there was a Mad Magazine. I think it goes all the way back to what could be the...
I think to the Renaissance, no? Isn't he? Renaissance figure. No,
it could be. But I think the original... character that looks like Alfred E. Newman was done for a calendar for Painless Dentist. And
I didn't know that.
Yes, I had no idea.
Yeah. And the line was, it didn't hurt a bit. You know, and he has this smile.
Right.
And
the gap,
and
too.
No, right. So it goes back a long way. I think that I have a reproduction of that calendar, and I think the date is 1910.
Holy moly.
So it goes a long way, but the originator of Mad Magazine, Harvey Kurtzman, took that character and made it a symbol for the magazine, and that's the way it came about. Huh.
Paul Coker is a cartoonist for many years with Mad Magazine, and once again, the show of his work is today. The opening is tonight from 5 till 8 at the Chuck Jones Gallery, of which Mike Bundy is the director. Thank you both so much for being with us on the Radio Cafe.
Thank you.
I'd like now to welcome to the program Susan Gardner. She's an artist and poet. Her new memoir is called Drawing the Line, and she will be at Collected Works Bookstore this coming Sunday, September 18th at 2 in the afternoon. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Thank you, Mary Charlotte, for inviting me.
So the title of the book, Drawing the Line, is kind of a double meaning of both drawing the line as drawing lines as an artist, art being a medium that really pushed your life forward in many positive ways, and also drawing boundaries about things that, against things that were happening to you that you wanted to keep out of your life.
Yes, absolutely. Some of it represents a line of travel because I've lived all over the world, and the lines that make our routes through our life and through the geographic space we occupy. And I suppose the hardest line to learn to draw is that boundary between what you want and what you would like not to have in your life.
So you basically had, I mean, it's there's a real generational thing going on, which is being a woman and getting into the kind of marriage which is really oppressive and then trying to get out of it. And your story is the story of so many women of your generation.
I think so. I think it's not only trying to get out of a marriage, but understanding what we used to promise and what was implied by those promises, not only in terms of marriage, but everything else. For example, I was accepted at MIT, and my father wouldn't allow me to go. He simply wouldn't sign the form. And in those days, for a girl or anybody to go to college, your parents had to sign their permission for you to go or their authorization for you to go. Later on, I went to graduate school, and I didn't know I was going to be the first woman in the doctoral program there. And
what were you studying?
Believe it or not, political science and economics at Johns Hopkins. And the professor was deeply troubled by the fact that I was there. And he said, "Too bad you're here. You were the best qualified, and they decided we had to take women. But you're probably using the space somebody else could have used better." And there were many other adventures like that.
And that affects your mind.
It makes you believe that you, well, it took me a little time, I suppose. But I guess I would say I'm either willful or perverse or stubborn or resolute, whichever one of those words you like. And I just, as I do to this day, I set my sights on where I'm going and put one foot in front of the other and keep going. And so when I went to Korea, it was a wonderful experience for the most part. I saw things, learned things, experienced things that I couldn't even have vaguely imagined before I got there.
What do you mean? Like what?
Well, I had no idea of the physicality of a Buddhist temple, for example, how free the experience is of being there, the way the colors and the sounds and the quiet of it can give you a kind of freedom in your mind that you wouldn't have anticipated. I mean, we talk about this, but experiencing it is something quite different, and in this book I do refer to it a few different times. I didn't know that I was going to fall in love with calligraphy. And I was thought as a child to have no talent whatsoever for this and was not encouraged to follow my interests in art. Even though I dreamed of being an artist, there was no encouragement for it. And so when I got to Korea, I decided, after I'd been there about 5 years, I started to take painting lessons as if it were going to be a hobby. And it turned out to be the center of my life. And I was able, this is one of the meanings of drawing the line, I was able to see that when I drew a line, there is a space inside that line. We think of a line as having two dimensions from one point to another. And yet there is a space inside that line, and we can enter that space and find a kind of silence and perfection there that invites us to let our mind go there and maybe even perceive that perfection momentarily. And that came from a lot of experiences that I think prepared the way for me, and I was open to it, but nevertheless it came as a huge surprise. I could not really, I was only in my 20s. I was about maybe 27, 28 years old when this all happened, and I'd had a lot of experiences. I'd experienced gorillas in the garden of my house, and seeing girls work in a silk factory, being a Peace Corps volunteer. A lot of other things had happened to me by the time I was, before I was 30 years old. And that kind of experience changes your life, only it takes time. And so even though I was in my 20s then and I'm in my 60s now, I'm still learning.
Your art was very much influenced by your time in Asia, by the art you saw and the practices you learned there.
Yes. In Japan, I had a wonderful calligraphy teacher. And she was the first person that really saw me as an artist. It's why she agreed to take me on as her student, because I was already an artist. And for 2 years, we met every Wednesday. And eventually, after our lessons, we started to go out together for lunch and to go to art exhibitions. And this whole relationship developed in Japanese. Eventually...
You spoke Japanese?
Yeah. Well, by the time I'd lived there for a while, I did.
Yeah.
She invited me to join their painting group, the disciples of the same artist who'd all been his students. And they got together, and by consensus, they invited me to join them. And I think at that time, I'm sure I was the only foreigner, and I don't think they've ever invited another foreigner to join them. But I was her student, and then her friend, and then a member of this same group called Seibokukai, the pure ink group. And I even exhibited with them. And so the day I left that part of Japan, we had a party. And I heard her speaking English, really beautiful English. And I said, you never told me you speak English. And she just smiled at me and said, we didn't need it, did we? And so that's really how I learned Japanese, by learning calligraphy.
So why did you decide to write a memoir at this point?
Well, we like to go to Barcelona. And it was kind of rainy. And I had been thinking about a friend of mine, a wonderful artist here in Santa Fe named Nick Levyach. And he died a few years ago. But when he was sick and we were talking, we talked a lot during the last months of his life, and he kept saying, Susan, write it down. Write down why we think we're artists. Write down why we believe that things need to be beautiful, why we believe what we do. And if you write it down, people will understand what we do better. And I thought that's what I started out to do. This book is really accidental in that, in order to talk about why I was an artist and why things needed to be the way they are, I needed a context, and that context turned out to be my whole life.
Susan Gardner's memoir is called Drawing the Line, A Passionate Life, and once again, she will be at Collected Works Bookstore this Sunday, the 18th of September, at 2 in the afternoon. Thank you for being with us on the Radio Cafe.
Thank you so much for having me, Mary Charlotte.
And I'd like right now to welcome Ben Swan. He is with the Santa Fe Animal Shelter and Humane Society, and we do a regular animal segment on this program. Welcome.
Thank you, Mary Charlotte. Great to be here.
So the Barkin' Ball is tomorrow.
Oh, it's a fabulous event. It's just so much fun. You know what's the best thing about the Barkin' Ball?
What?
Which is at 5 p.m. at the Santa Fe Community Convention Center, is
you
get to bring your dog with you and dress them up in cowboy gear. In fact, I'm wearing cowboy boots right now to get in the spirit of it. I'm not really a cowboy kind of person, but I thought this is a great one, and Robert Knott should go to, but he can't come, and you can't either, but it's going to be an awesome thing because our theme this year is the real Barkin' Ball, R-E-E-L.
Uh-huh.
And that's, we take this old
Western... Is it a fishing metaphor or
metaphor with old Western films and things like that. We've got Jay Oliver did these awesome posters, old Western film posters that she's superimposed animals in them. And kind of did a twist on their the titles, you know. So the cat looks for this or something like that. It's just on the Western Trail or, you know. It's
excellent.
Yeah.
And I've gone with my dachshund a couple of times, and it's a little bit zooey with all the dogs, but it's remarkably, how should we say, It's actually remarkably calm, considering that there are so many dogs in that giant ballroom.
Yeah, and you know, in all the years they've done it, they have very few issues. And the thing about it is, that's great. We've got a lot of people looking to make sure that the dogs are happy. There's little break areas.
Somebody takes them outside.
We have something called the Rin Tin Tins Relief Area. Some hay and some things like that. So it really, you know, we take that theme, that Old West theme, and really expand upon it. In fact, the first hour is going to be called the Hopalongs Hour, which is sort of like in the courtyard. And it's a lot of fun because you're going to meet and greet people, and your dogs can meet and greet them outside so they can get used to just being around a lot of different people.
So Bark and Ball is the annual fundraiser for the Santa Fe Animal Shelter and Humane Society. And there's always wonderful food, lots of dogs, a parade of pets, a parade of dogs, and a silent auction.
The silent auction is really awesome this year. We just had an outpouring of support from the community and artists that have donated us, you know, all kinds of really exquisite art, as well as just practical art and jewelry and gift certificates. I think it's one of our best that we've had for silent auction pieces. And I do want to say that...
I love silent auctions.
They're fun because you can just write, you can... go to have a drink, write your, you know, your bid on them, go
you
back,
take
a
look.
You
don't know what you're
going
to go home with. There's cool stuff that you would never buy otherwise.
Exactly. And you talked about the Parade of Pets, and this year, of course, because you're off on the East Coast this weekend, or next weekend, it's Rula.
Yes. Stacy Pearl, Santa Fe's own Mouth of Wonder host.
Yes.
She's going to be doing the Parade of Pets.
With me. We'll be co-hosting the Parade of Pets. I'm not really quite sure how it'll work, but it's going to be a lot of fun.
Now, you also have some animals that are up for adoption.
As always, we have some beautiful pets, or dogs and cats, that are just waiting for the right family. And, you know, I wanted to mention that this we have an adoption special going on through this month. Really inexpensive adoption fees. And just so we can connect. You know, this is kind of our busy season. Kennels are full. We're trying to get people to come in and visit with the animals and take somebody home. So I wanted to talk about Maya. She's a very happy girl. Her tail's always wagging when you see her. She loves people and other dogs and loves to play in water. Maya is a little black mixed dog. It's just lovely.
Little black mixed dog.
Yes. And Betty, I guess, is a large domestic short-haired tortoiseshell cat. Do you like cats? Let's not talk about cats. Cats are wonderful creatures. And
so I hear.
No, they are. And there's lots of things you can do if you're allergic to them. But anyway, Betty...
Really? There's lots of things you can do if you're allergic to them?
Yeah, I should give you a list of things. Like, you know, mostly it's about keeping clean, making sure...
Are you suggesting that I am unclean?
No, I'm suggesting that you might want to just vacuum a bit more. Like, I need to vacuum a bit more. With five dogs, I've got a lot of dog hair. And if I wait a whole week...
Yeah, but I'm telling you, Ben, if I go and pat a cat and don't wash my hands right away, I get things like eyeball blisters and nasty...
You know what? I bet there's a lot of people out there who could probably come up with a lot of tips for you to deal with your cat.
RadioCafe@KSFR.org is my email.
And send them to me as well, just so I can make sure to pass on the tips. That's bswan@sfhumanesociety.org.
All right. Anyway. Good.
Oh, Betty.
Betty.
Incredibly sweet, cute, lovable, and just waiting for the right person to lavish her affection on. You know, cats, they really love to just sort of get into one person, and that's their person, and that's what Betty is.
Right. All right, good. And many more animals available at the Santa Fe Animal Shelter and Humane Society, mostly dogs and cats, a few other animals as well.
Rabbits, don't forget rabbits. We have, you know, wonderful volunteers who work with rabbits, who love the rabbits, and really will give you a kind of a tips on how to properly care for rabbits. They're much more complicated than people imagine, but much more rewarding.
Than people imagine.
Exactly. Unfortunately, rabbits can't come to the Bark and Ball, but I hope to see you there tomorrow.
No. If rabbits came to the Bark and Ball, there would be fewer rabbits than before.
Then we'd have greyhounds, too, and then it would be, well, no. Kind of an interesting kind of a thing.
Ben Swan is with the Santa Fe Animal Shelter and Humane Society. Bark and Ball tomorrow night, and much more to come.
If you wanted to buy any tickets, it's 983-4309, extension 202.
Thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you, Mary.
You can Google Santa Fe Animal Shelter, and you will find information on the web as well. Thank you for being with us.
Thank you, Mary Charlotte. I appreciate it.
You've been listening to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. My name is Mary Charlotte. We're streaming live on the web at ksfr.org, podcasting at santafe.radiocafe.org. Thanks to Dotfoil Computer Services. You can subscribe to the show on iTunes. You can find us at facebook.com/radiocafe, and my email address is radiocafe@ksfr.org. Stay tuned for the BBC, then local news, then jazz.